Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how the world will look and sound different once we can converse with our computers. We'll spend this hour with tech writer James Vlahos, who will explain why the rudimentary exchanges we can have with Siri and Alexa today are such a crowning achievement in computer programming, and also why they're likely to strike us as primitive once we live in environments where computers are everywhere waiting to respond to our commands. We'll talk about the race by Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and Facebook to be the first to perfect lifelike computer intelligence. And we'll hear about Vlahos' own experiments with artificial intelligence, a dad bot he programmed to draw on many hours of recordings made before his father died a few years ago. Our conversation starts after a short break. Computers are great at many things. Stimulating conversation isn't one of them.
Most digital voices sound flat and awkward, and some ideas are hard for AI to comprehend, since computers don't experience a world the way humans do. But voice computing interfaces are rapidly improving, and in the future, we'll interact with technology using less typing and more talking. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. Now back to Chris Boyd.
Pretty sure my job is safe, at least for now. Most voice interfaces are fairly basic at the moment, but even the fact that a machine can listen to your words and follow your instructions is a towering achievement of computer science. And as my guest will explain, Siri and Alexa, as we know them today, are really just the beginning. James Vlahos is a contributor to the New York Times Magazine, Wired, Popular Science, Scientific American, and other publications. His book is called Talk to Me: How Voice Computing Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Think. James, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on.
So Google CEO believes the next big step for devices will be that devices sort of fade away and computers are just everywhere in our environments. What will that look and sound like?
Well, this is the thesis known as ambient computing. And if you take a step back and you think of, we had computers that filled whole rooms, mainframe computers, then they got smaller and they started sitting on our desktops. Then they got even smaller and they fit into our pockets. And this last step of ambient computing is for sort of this concept of the device itself as this sort of embodied object that we hold or look at, that it fades away. And just anywhere where you can have a Wi-Fi connected microphone, which could be, you know, could be a phone, but it could also be a toilet or a light switch or just anywhere in your environment, that's a computer. And that's a connection to an AI. So it means that anything that's available digitally, any type of intelligence information that's available digitally, is available to you there just in the air. And all it takes is speaking to invoke that.
Wow. I think digital toilets are a whole other program, so we'll skip that part. But how much bigger is the potential market for voice computing and this ambient computing as compared with, say, the current market for mobile technology?
Well, mobile technology, I mean, I think we're approaching the point where we practically average a phone for every person on the planet. But if you start counting up just in your own environment, well, how many light switches or refrigerators or just, you know, devices, consumer electronics devices, just home contraptions do you have? Imagine each one of those potentially having a microphone. You do the math and you start getting towards 100 billion potentially is the number of devices.
It's easy to underestimate how many problems had to be solved in order to allow computers to respond to even really simple voice commands. We've all had that experience of talking to Siri or Alexa or Cortana and sort of rolling our eyes. Why is it so much harder to make computers listen and talk back to us than it is to make computers that respond to text queries?
Well, this is a moment to pat yourself on the back for being a human. For the most part, we are really, really good at language, at understanding language, at communicating through language. And in fact, we're so good at it that we don't appreciate how many processes and subprocesses there are to make that work. And it's everything from transforming sound waves into words to decoding the meanings of those words, to coming up with a response that makes sense relative to those words, and then audibilizing that response. So for a computer, each one of those tasks you have to teach it. And really, since the dawn of digital computing, people have had this idea like, oh, wouldn't it be neat if we could teach computers to communicate in natural language? And sort of every decade goes by, and instead of the process seeming simpler than it was in the past, it becomes more complicated. It's like, oh, no, we need to figure out this. We need to figure out that. So it's very difficult. And progress is being made. But we've all been there. I've personally had swearing fits at Siri, and you just have to pause and say, like, no, this is tough. And the fact that it works at all, even on a limited basis, is a big technological achievement.
Yeah. So something you point out in the book that I hadn't thought much about is that the computers we've used for years now that we enter a ton of text into, download a ton of text from, they don't necessarily understand any of the language we type into them.
No, they're doing what's known as information retrieval oftentimes. And that's just, you know, you think of even your classic Google search. You're typing some words, the search algorithms are finding some bit of content, a page that has a correspondence with those words. And that's sort of a pattern matching problem, but it's not we really understand on a deep level what it is that you're asking about. Now a lot of progress is being made in that area, but it's still challenging because what you realize when you say something to anybody, whether it's a computer or another being, the meaning is only partly contained in your words. Hmm. And a lot of it you have to bring in your entire knowledge of, you know, what happens in the world, what's possible in the world, how humans work, how the natural laws of the universe work. You kind of bring in all of this knowledge to help you decode just, you know, the 6 to 12 words that somebody said to you.
So last night, my daughter was reading something aloud from a school textbook, and the phrase society's gaze came up. And for a half second, my brain went to society's G-A-Y-S. And I realized based on context that she meant G-A-Z-E. How do voice recognition systems do that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, that's tough. I mean, that's a classic problem. And I mean, think of a word like two, you know, is it T-W-O?
Yeah.
Is it T-O? Is it T-O-O? So there was sort of a classic approach to this where computer scientists really sought to teach machines, you know, the rules of grammar. And, you know, for instance, if the word two that I was just giving, if that came before another word, which the computer had identified as being a verb, well, like, okay, we think that's probably T-O because T-O comes before a verb, to run, to fly, whatever. If it comes before a noun, well, maybe that's TWI because we're saying two houses or something like that. That process doesn't work. It ultimately fails. So now the new approach involves using machine learning, where a computer is just, you know, it's looking at massive batches of human speech and seeing based on patterns in the past. You know, for your example, I guess it would have to decide whether society's gaze, G-A-Y-S, or society's gaze, G-A-Z-E, was statistically more probable to have occurred based on all the language examples it had seen in the past. So that's the new way. It's not perfect either, but it's showing better promise in some ways than the old way.
Yeah, and machine learning has some interesting hazards associated with it. You know, garbage in, garbage out. You write about some examples of using, I guess, a chat program to sort of take the way people spoke naturally, and there was a lot of stuff in there that we really didn't want computers repeating.
Oh, right. So, yeah, especially it comes to kind of chit-chat conversation, computer scientists have, you know, they're looking for these sources of just people, you know, chatting around. So they've gone to annotations of movie subtitles where you have natural dialogue, or Reddit threads where there's a lot of natural conversation. And the problems you might guess from both of these is you have a lot of swearing, you have a lot of, you know, sexist, racist, just otherwise inappropriate language that's in there because, unfortunately, that's how some humans out there talk. And the computers kind of learn, like, hey, well, if this is what humans say, maybe I will say it too. And there's an unpredictability in when that's going to pop up, and it's caused a lot of problems. Microsoft's chatbot Tay was in the news a couple years back for having started to spout a whole bunch of things that were very inappropriate, and that was fundamentally the problem behind it.
So is there a way that programmers can give computers the kind of background knowledge that will help them make sense of a world that they haven't physically experienced? There are so many things that, you know, like a six-year-old is aware of just based on being a citizen of the world.
There's so many things that a two-year-old is aware of. You know, like a ball is rolling off a table. The thing that's going to happen next is it's going to fall to the ground due to gravity. So there have been very constrained attempts to do that. There was a pioneering program in the 70s called Shurdloo, which was just, it had this kind of imaginary universe with some blocks within an environment. And the programmer tried to teach the computer, you know, just within this very limited world with about, you know, a dozen objects, what are things that are likely to happen? And then it could be asked questions about that. More recently, there are efforts to expand that, like teach reasoning, common sense to computers. And that's, it's a very interesting frontier, and it's where a lot of people think we need to go next. But it's also fairly early along for that in terms of payoffs.
One of the first movers into a commercial application for voice computing was Apple. What sort of revolution did Siri launch, and what sort of shockwaves did it send through the rest of the tech world?
Well, that was, I mean, it was really a mind-blowing product for its time. And that was something, it was the first time stepping from science fiction to reality that you could speak with the computer and have it speak back. There had certainly been chatbots like Eliza that you could use on a computer and type to it and type back. But in terms of a consumer product that everybody could use and that had the backing of a company like Apple, it was a really big deal. There was, unfortunately, almost immediately, there was huge hype. There was huge excitement. Apple's arguably overpromised on what Siri could actually do and under-delivered. So the hype was followed by a trough of sorrow when people found out, oh, Siri is not nearly as smart as she seems on the commercials. And that, many people believe, set back conversational computing and conversational AI. And I write about that in the book, that there was this sort of, and I think it lingers to this day, people who had bad experiences with Siri several years ago still kind of think like, these things are dumb, they don't get me, and why would I bother?
Right. Like Zoe Deschanel can order tomato soup on a rainy day, but it doesn't work in one step for most of the rest of us.
Right.
So one interesting, actually, consequence for us as users is that when we type in a search, we get lots of choices and we can click on the one that seems like it might work for us or click on multiple choices. When we ask a computer to look for information, particularly product information, it's going to pick one thing for us that might not actually reflect what we really wanted.
Yeah, so that's called a one-shot answer in the search community. And that's this notion of, yeah, rather than a long list of links, you give a single answer. This happens in the visual realm, like you've probably noticed lately with increasing frequency. You do a Google search and you see in some kind of a box, you know, a top of everything at the very top, it's called position zero. You'll just see an answer to your question. And, you know, the idea with that is like, oh, it's enormously convenient. You don't have to navigate to some other page. You don't have to root around through that page to find what you're looking for. Boom, there it is right for you. And so that's, you know, it's becoming a very nice to have feature in visual search results. If you start thinking about asking Siri or Alexa or Google Assistant a question, that one-shot answer becomes a must-have feature because they can't sit there drone on, you know, link after link. They just have to give you what you're looking for. So it sort of consolidates the power of the search engine or the voice AI to, we're going to take it out of your hands to decide what you want. We're going to tell you what it is that you want to hear.
But of course, you know, how many teaspoons in a tablespoon is really different from why did the Civil War happen?
Right, right. And there's questions where there's multiple legitimate perspectives, and that's difficult for an AI to deliver as just one single answer. But then there's also, you know, this idea that all these content creators out there, and whether they're the New York Times or a Wikipedia contributor or an individual, that, you know, they don't get the direct traffic of people coming to their site. It's just an extracted answer that gets read to them by the AI.
My guest is journalist James Vlahos. We're talking about his book, Talk to Me, How Voice Computing Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Think. ¶¶ listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with journalist James Vlahos, who contributes to the New York Times Magazine, Wired, Popular Science, and other publications. His new book is called Talk to Me, How Voice Computing Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Think. If you've got a question, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So just to return for a minute, James, to the pros and cons of these one-shot answers. As you mentioned, you know, there are lots of organizations that might make money off the traffic that they'd receive from advertising or whatever else if someone actually goes to their page. But if a voice-controlled computer delivers information harvested from their page, they get nothing, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's these kind of clumsy workarounds where, you know, Google will say, you know, well, you can go, even if you did a voice search, you can then look online later at the history of your voice queries, and you can see where that answer came from, and then you can go to that site. But it's just hard to imagine that people would do that in more than a tiny fraction of the cases. So there's a big potential for lost traffic. So we're on one hand, we're talking about, the whole world of content production is already reeling financially in terms of it, what supports content from what's happened with Google and Facebook. And this is just sort of a further step in that direction in terms of the consolidation of monetizing of search. And then beyond sort of the money aspect, there's just the control of knowledge aspect to this discussion of, you know, forget going to a library and looking at a book, and forget even, you know, sort of you rooting around a bunch of different web pages, finding information and sort of arriving at what you think is factually supported truth. Here, you're just getting an answer handed to you, served up on a plate. So you're really kind of passing off that, your own responsibility to find knowledge to a big tech company.
Amazon has now sold a huge number of devices with its Alexa interface. Why was Amazon such an unlikely company to be a major player in this space?
Well, at the time that they first got interested in this, and this came from Jeff Bezos himself, this interest, the company had two people working for it who had an expertise in conversational AI and anything related to that. So they were starting absolutely from zero. And, you know, the company did have a search engine in the sense that, you know, product search is very much a type of search, but it didn't have this expertise that, say, that Google did at interpreting natural language queries and sending back information. So they were really starting, you know, way, way from behind in all of this. But they managed to, they got the device right before anybody else did. With Echo, and it's been called an AI-first, the world's first AI-first device, where, you know, it's not, the voice part isn't just some adjunct feature the way it is on your iPhone. It's the feature. Like, that's what it's there for. It's this speaker that talks to you, and you talk to it.
So the name Alexa is a reference to the Library of Alexandria.
Right, right. So it, you know, shows off the grandiose ambitions for how much knowledge or help you could get from this technology.
So I have one of these at my house. The one thing I don't ever use it for is shopping. And that's because I like to bargain hunt, and Amazon doesn't necessarily give you a chance to do that. How popular has the shopping feature been?
It's not huge yet, but it is expected to grow rapidly to something like $40 billion per year in the U.S. By 2022. And, you know, there are some clear drawbacks. Obviously, you also can't necessarily see what you're shopping for, which is why Amazon has rolled out the Echo Show, a device that's both a voice device but has a screen. So you can have a hybrid. Just because you're using your voice doesn't mean there's no visual element at all. And maybe that's actually the most potent pairing, is to have both. But for kind of think of more like just mundane, everyday things. You're in the kitchen. Oh, we're out of Frosted Flakes. Alexa, add Frosted Flakes or buy me Frosted Flakes, whatever it is. Maybe I should have used a healthier cereal for my example. But so for all those kind of commodity good purchases that you just make over and over again, that's where you can see voice will be very easy, very frictionless. Just the moment you think you need something, you can speak that request, and then it's essentially on the way to you.
What is the Alexa Prize?
The Alexa Prize is a contest launched by Amazon with a goal of creating social bots that can have small talk conversations with users lasting up to 20 minutes. Hmm. So this is the opposite type of conversation that a goal-oriented or a utility conversation, like set timer for 20 minutes or play this playlist, whatever it is. This is just people chatting with the computer chatting back about movies or books or the weather or whatever it is. And what Amazon does is it's a global contest. It's university graduate students in computer science from around the world. They apply to enter. Amazon then selects the top, dozen or so teams, and then they compete to develop the social bot that is most successful at having those types of conversations. So it's kind of a giant, I don't know what to call it, a game show, a reality show with bots and people and Alexa users around the world having chats with these social bots and rating them. And those ratings become the basis for which team ultimately wins a prize of more than $1 million.
So people might be listening to this and thinking, I don't want to talk to, a box in my kitchen or my living room. But it turns out lots of people do this, and they do it after midnight when everyone else is asleep and they're lonely.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is Amazon was, I covered this contest for Wired and in reporting the book as well. And Amazon was surprisingly candid about this, that some users really do just want to chat. This is a user behavior we're noticing. And instead of, asking for something, they just say, "Hey, Alexa, what's up?" And nothing's up with Alexa. Alexa is an AI. But they're sort of expecting, you can just picture the person. They're home alone, and they just want something to fill the space or fill the silence. And maybe it's no different than we come home and we turn on the radio or we turn on the TV. Sometimes we just want a voice when we're alone. And this is an interactive version of that voice.
Why is that voice so often female?
Well, you can take this, depends on how far back you want to go. The first phone operators, starting in the late 19th century and certainly, for a long time, were all female. And they were trained. I've seen a training manual where they say, you want to be, helpful, a little bit flirty, knowledgeable. So it kind of created this, the public was trained basically for decades that you wanted to ask a voice for help, that voice should be female. And then stepping more into the modern era, when you ask the tech companies about this, they say, people just say they prefer, men and women alike in general, tend to prefer a female voice. And I was really interested in this, and I went looking for the scientific papers that would back that finding and didn't really find them. The findings are more equivocal on whether we like men's voices or women's voices. It's quite possible that inside of Google, inside of Amazon, they've done their product testing research. And indeed, most users are asking for a female voice. But it's seen as problematic. It's seen as sexist because, your virtual assistant is, assistant. So it's kind of the secretary in my life is a female. So there's a lot of pushback on that issue right now.
It depends. You can look at her as a secretary or you can look at her as the dispenser of all knowledge.
Well, I guess that's a glass half full right there, isn't it?
So programmers, in addition to having to figure out how to make these things understand human speech with the huge range of pronunciations and accents that people might have and then respond appropriately, have to also think about how much personality or how little personality to give these things. Talk about how Microsoft and Apple and Amazon have made those choices.
Well, I heard an interesting story from Adam Chire, who was one of the original developers of Siri, and he didn't really want to go big on personification. And he just thought, why would you want that? And people are just going to want to get their answers or their information as quickly as possible. But he was talked into it a little bit, we should have some jokes and we should think of what Siri's persona is. So he went along with it and then was greatly surprised that after Siri first came out, that was sort of at the top of the list of things that people seem to talk about. Like, oh, look at this funny response that Siri said me. And there was sort of a famous example where you could ask Siri where to hide a body and she would recommend, you know, foundries or, you know, dumps or whatever. So it was this kind of black humor, but it was funny that an AI was making it. So that's continued. And most, I think all of the major virtual assistant makers, they have personality teams, and their job really is just to sit around and think like, well, you know, if Siri was a person, what would she look like? If Cortana was a person, what would she look like? What are her hobbies? What are her favorite? Cortana has favorite books.
Wow.
She likes A Wrinkle in Time. She likes the band Kraftwerk. She likes the food jicama. She likes to try waffles. So it's really bizarre, but I think in thinking through those things, it also helps the writers and the conversation designers behind these AIs make some creative choices about how the virtual assistant, the voice assistant, should express itself.
And everybody, with the exception of maybe very young children and maybe elderly folks who are having some cognitive problems, people understand they're talking to a machine, but they don't care. Like, you found that people who have to take their Roombas in for servicing are really afraid that their Roomba's personality will come back different?
Yeah, I didn't find that. There was a study that was a published paper where they surveyed hundreds of Roomba users.
Wow.
And found that. And it goes back a long ways that we seem to, it's animism, basically. Like, we want to believe that these objects around us have some type of personality or sentience. And, you know, a lot of us name our cars and talk to our cars. So we do that with no help at all from the technological object. So when the object actually does have a personality of sorts and it talks back to us, then, you know, game on. All right. You're a being with a personality.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Toby calling from Addison. Hey, Toby.
Hey, really, really interesting conversation, but I have to tell you, and I think I'm probably maybe like a lot of other people, I hope, I'm finding your conversation really, really alarming, especially when you got to the point about, I'm losing my train of thought, but the alarming part is that I don't understand how people are already trying to isolate themselves from other people, in my opinion, every single day in every way they can. And now they're coming up with artificial intelligences that will help them do that even more. And I have to guess the end result is going to be basically like in some science fiction movie, everybody being in their own little cocoon and they're dealing with Alexa or whatever disembodied voice, and nobody has to deal with anybody else. And the problem with that is when people actually get out into the world in the supermarket or they're driving or anything like that, they do actually have to deal with other people, and it's I think just making the world worse and worse and worse. And I hate to be negative, but and I don't know what the answer is, but it's the whole conversation is, I think, rather alarming. Interesting, but alarming.
Well, thanks for your call. What do you think about all that, James?
I think those are very valid points. I don't know that I necessarily disagree with any of it. I think the only sort of alternate perspective to consider there is, we're already pretty isolated. We already sit around by ourselves. We spend a lot of time by ourselves watching TV. This type of technology, at least it's interactive. You're saying something, the technology is saying something back. For that to happen, there's a lot of sort of human element, for lack of a better word, that is being infused into these devices. You know, there are people who are sitting, like we've been discussing, thinking through what these AIs should say. So, you know, arguably maybe this is, if we're already marooned or isolated with our technologies, at least now these technologies are becoming more interactive and less passive.
So what will it take before we have bots or digital assistants that use our voices, maybe have aspects of our personalities, and they can call and make us a dinner reservation or a dentist appointment?
Well, it's funny you should ask that. I just in the past week tried this new feature from Google called, Duplex. It was demonstrated at the Google Developers Conference last year and got a lot of fanfare and also was immediately controversial. So the way this works is I just asked Google Assistant, make me a dinner reservation on Wednesday for two at this restaurant in Berkeley called Gather. And from there, it's in the AI's hands. An AI calls Gather, speaks with sort of this pleasant human-like voice, identifies that it's the Google Assistant, but then proceeds to do the back-and-forth conversation with the woman who answered the phone to make me the reservation. So I was really, it worked. But I couldn't hear any of it. So after I found out that it worked, I called the restaurant and asked the woman who took the call, like, so what was that like? And she said, well, you know, Google was perfectly pleasant, a little bit awkward, couldn't say your name right, but otherwise it worked. So right there, there's an AI that's sort of acting as my avatar in the real world. Now, I don't know if this is where you were going with that question. There's also, you know, there are companies now that can make digital clones of your voice if you provide it with some examples of you speaking. So that are, you know, they start to, I tried one of those too, and the clone of my voice didn't sound perfectly like me, but it sort of sounded like me. Maybe Google or some other company will start making these automated calls using our actual voices in the future.
My guest is journalist James Vlahos. We're talking about his new book, Talk to Me, How Voice Computing Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Think. You can join our conversation by calling with your real voice or your robot voice, 1-800-933-5372. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist James Vlahos, whose new book is called Talk to Me, How Voice Computing Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Think. You can join us at 800-933-5372. James, before your dad died, you went to him with an interesting proposal. What did you want to do?
I proposed to turn him into a chatbot. This was in 2016. The family got a very unexpected and unwelcome news that he had been diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. And he had, you know, probably a matter of months to live. And this immediately kicked into gear this sort of long simmering plan, back burner plan to do an oral history project with him, something my brother and I had talked about. So that happened first, and I just sat down with him for, you know, 10 or so sessions, each one an hour or so apiece, and just had him talk through his whole life, from what he knew about his ancestors in Greece, his mom and dad, to his childhood, growing up, going to Cal, becoming a lawyer, his hobbies like musical theater, meeting my mom, having a family, just kind of the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had that, and we got all these recordings transcribed. We printed them out. We put them in a book, and it was just sort of 200 pages of type staring back at us. And that was right at the time where I was getting started with researching this book, and I was learning about some of the platforms for creating, you know, chatbots and conversational AIs and the rest of it. And I thought, hey, maybe I could do something different, and I could make an interactive version of the oral history project where you could kind of talk to or chat with a version of my dad, and he could share this information with you.
How about you sing me a Cal song?
Oh, the Cardinals be damn, boys, the Cardinals be damn. The Cardinals be damn, boys, the Cardinals be damn.
It seems like your dad must have been a very fun-loving guy.
He really was. Yeah, I mean, he was, on one hand, he was the managing partner of a pretty good-sized law firm in San Francisco. He spoke multiple languages. He was very worldly and educated, but his persona was not the alpha male persona or the I'm smarter than you persona. He just had this kind of warm, loving, and sort of mischievous and humorous personality that he presented to you, and, you know, was just a wonderful man.
So when you interact with the dad bot, with the version where you can actually hear things that your dad said to you and saying to you, I mean, how does it make you feel? Do you feel closer to him, or do you feel like it's just a like a simulacrum that can't, obviously it can't take the place of a flesh and blood person?
Yeah, what works well about what I created is that it's good enough to do its job, which is to provide reminders of my dad, and it's not nearly so sophisticated that it just even comes close to being that like fake AI dad. Like,
yeah.
It's not there. You know, the primary interface for what I built is sending messages back and forth using the Facebook Messenger platform. Then sometimes you get these audio clips too, like the one you just heard, where he sings or tells a joke or tells a particular family story. And, you know, it just, when I hear it, it's so him.
Hmm.
So it just kind of takes me, brings his being into my mind in a fresh and vivid way.
Have you thought, well, you should start working on one of these now for your kids someday?
I guess that's talk about back burner projects, but yes, yeah, maybe I should. And I've thought about like how I would build these types of things for other people and how I would have it more voice centered versus, you know, this hybrid of text and voice.
It does seem like the sort of thing that, you know, in the same way that lots of people who had kids after, you know, video technology was available wish that they had these things. It seems like once that's out there, lots of people might want it.
Yeah. So I wrote an article for Wired about this whole Dadbot project, and I was blown away. I mean, I had media and just sort of ordinary people from around the world contacting me. And many of them saying, like, you know, either like, I wish I had had this for my own dad or mom who passed away several years ago. Some people saying, hey, could you build something like this for me? Like, I'm dying or my relative is dying. Some very sad stories I heard in that vein. So I feel like there is a hunger for this type of memorializing technology.
Should we be uncomfortable with the fact that we're putting technology right now in our palms and maybe in our homes, pretty soon everywhere in our environment, that is listening to us all the time?
Yes. Yes is the answer. I think that's a concern. You know, there have been a few controversies and scandals that have played out in the news of, you know, an Alexa device that was listening or a Google Home device that was listening when somebody hadn't authorized it. But those have really been, they've been kind of fluky, like weird little bugs that caused them to happen. Like, I don't think people should be worried that these things are just pervasively listening to us and that Google and Amazon are lying to us about the fact that they don't listen unless you authorize the listening. But, you know, the conversation that's not happening, that should be happening, is, well, when you do authorize use and when you say, you know, Alexa, or you say, hey, Google, and the interaction process starts, then that recording is fair game. And they can collect that data and they can analyze that data. And it's just a potent new channel. And it's more personal. I mean, these companies already know a lot about us by what we shop and what we search for. But to now have listening to these more sort of, you know, you're in the kitchen or the car or the living room and those types of interactions, it's pretty personal. And it's our actual voices. There's something about that that feels a little bit different than just typing to a computer and having that captured.
All right, let's go to the phone. 800-933-5372 is our number. Brett is calling from Burleson. Hi, Brett.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
It sounds like you've been talking about issues similar to my question. I'm wondering if these breakthroughs in AI voice technology is allowing for the possibility of a different kind of identity theft, i.e. someone stealing your voice print, as it were, or your voice recording, and then taking it to do things that you allows you access to in our society, if that makes sense.
Is anybody looking into this, James?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there's two things that I think are going on there with that question. There's one, the idea of there's a voice print sometimes that's used for a security authentication measure. So if somebody, you know, stole your voice, copies of your voice, they could have that voice print and maybe use that to unlock things in the way of a password. That's one aspect. Then the other thing that immediately sprung to mind is, so there's this company called Liarbird, and a couple years ago they released these voice clones of the voices of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump. And you hear them, and they're so recognizable as being those three politicians. And that tech is only going to get better. So one of the things I wrote about in the book is, you know, you think we have a fake news problem now. Imagine when the public sphere is filled with the voices of politicians or celebrities saying things they never actually said, like these are simulations of their voices. And, you know, maybe we'll figure it out eventually that this was a fake. But often, you know, with scandals and misinformation, the damage gets done and it's hard to undo once it's happened.
Wow. All right. Maybe we'll have to figure out some kind of verification. I mean, I don't even know how you would do that.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, in that the whole, you know, they're using neural nets to make detailed copies of your voice. There is a technology called, it's probably getting too deep in the weeds, but generative adversarial networks, where you have two neural networks and one network is basically trying to fool the other. Hmm. And it helps the computer that's potentially being fooled to spot fakes. So I don't know if that's an area, an application of that technology for security, of weeding out these fake voices.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go back to the phones. Jay is on the line in Weatherford. Hi, Jay.
Hello, how are you today?
Very well, thanks.
So my question, I asked specifically about Siri because I've got an iPhone, but it kind of would go across the spectrum of these devices. Will they ever get where they can understand Texas?
You mean like
when I talk to Siri, it has no idea what I'm trying to ask.
Huh? Thanks for calling.
It doesn't even get close.
What about those regional dialects that we have that are so charming but maybe would confuse AI?
Yeah, it's a real problem that Jay is having, and it's been reported on elsewhere. You know, both regional accents and dialects, you know, slang and idioms that get used, ways of speaking, then also, you know, people speaking a language as a second language speaker, people even, you know, say you're sort of using Spanglish and you're jumping back and forth between two languages. So it's all those challenges that we discussed at the top of the show of how difficult it is for computers to understand speech becomes even harder once you mix in these additional things. And I think the short answer to Jay's question is you know, they're working on it. They are trying to do better. And as they collect more examples of people speaking with particular accents, the computers get better at sort of identifying those and then being able to process them.
As we start to create environments where microphones and speakers are everywhere, it seems very hard to avoid being captured by this technology, even if you choose not to engage with it, right? Like you can decide what you type into a search engine or whatever, but if you're just at a store somewhere and something is watching you, there's no way to get around that.
Yeah, there's almost like an audio bycatch issue. So, you know, one person is speaking to their voice device and it's picking up you speaking in the background. So that's a possibility. You know, whether it would be, I'm trying to think of applications where it might be used in, you know, public settings. And the problem is once you're in the public and you have a lot of speakers, you can't sort of be vacuuming up everybody's speech at once, because that just becomes too messy to process individual words out of that. So that's maybe lower down the list of concerns. Maybe don't cross it off, but keep it lower on the list.
Well, I think about even 10 years ago, certainly 20, there were people who said, I will never have a mobile phone. I don't believe in that. And there's pretty much nobody who doesn't have that now. And back in the 80s, you know, when personal computers were first a thing, there were lots of people who said, I'll never have a computer. I don't trust them. I don't like them. Everybody's got one now or knows how to use one. I mean, will this technology inevitably affect everyone's life in the future?
I think it absolutely will, in the same ways that you suggested with these previous technologies. And, you know, especially when, you know, I think of my own kids, limited sample size, but how much easier it is for them. You know, they're looking for some information. They don't always say like, oh, could we do a Google search for that? They just say, ask Siri. Mm-hmm. That's their go-to. So it doesn't even seem that like special or magical to them that you could ask a computer a question and get an answer. So for everybody who's coming up where it's just been around, like they're not going to have a problem with adoption. And yeah, you just get that tipping point where it becomes inescapable.
It seems like it'll change our culture as well as just the technology that we have to constantly be talking to computers. It still feels a little awkward for me, even though I'll make a request of my Siri or Alexa. It feels strange to talk to my device.
Just as it did to walk around on the street. I mean, remember when you saw people talking on a mobile phone on the street many years ago, and you think, like, who's that idiot? Why don't they shut up? So it'll become more natural. There still is a stigma. But there's also, you know, there's been patent applications and some early research from companies like Apple where they're looking at, like, can we process whispered speech? Can we process even when somebody is just mouthing the words and there's some sensors mounted on their necks what they're saying so that you don't have to just awkwardly say those requests out loud?
James Vlahos is a contributor to the New York Times Magazine, Wired, Popular Science, Scientific American, and other publications. His new book is called Talk to Me: How Voice Computing Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Think. James, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed the conversation.
You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. If you'd like to subscribe to the podcast, you can do that using your favorite podcast app. And if you want to learn what we have planned for upcoming shows or just listen to the show right on the website, you can do that at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.